This morning we're going to start with a reading from Philippians chapter 1, verses 20 through 23. If you'll turn there. So good to see Nancy and Jenny with us today, that they're well enough to be out. We've got a lot of praying to do for some of our members who are struggling, and we want to stay constant in our petitions to God for Kelly and for Dave and for all of us with our situations that we're dealing with. But let me begin here in verse 20 of Philippians chapter 1. According to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit for my labor, yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. I'm mainly wanting to talk about verse 21 this morning, but to get to verse 21, we need to go through verse 20. And verse 20 is a bold statement. I mean, that's what Paul says, that with all boldness. And I think from this verse, there are at least three areas of boldness that we can identify. The first is that Paul boldly was concerned for God's glory. He wanted Christ to be magnified. So also now shall Christ be magnified in my body. Paul wanted Christ to be seen to be great in his life. I said this the other day, when you look through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars, everything that's big looks small. But when you look through the right end of the pair of binoculars, what's small looks big. Paul wanted to be someone that when people viewed Christ through him, they were seeing him through the right end, that Christ might be magnified. Now, there's a political expression I'm sure you've heard of, MAGA, Make America Great Again. I don't think Paul would ever have said something like make the Jews great again, or make Judah great again, or make the Roman Empire great again. What Paul's banner was MACA, make Christ great again. That Christ be magnified. His concern was for his Christ, not for himself. He was in prison. His primary concern was not that he be released. His primary concern that even with him in prison, Christ might be magnified, made to look bigger in the eyes of people. So he was bold in having a concern for the glory of God. He was bold, secondly, in having a contempt for his own comfort. Because he says he wants Christ to be magnified, whether by his life or by his death, whether he does so in jail or out of jail, whether he does so in health or out of health, he wanted Christ to be magnified. Salvation is not just difficult sometimes. Sometimes it's downright dangerous. And Paul was in jail because he was a follower of Jesus Christ. He had no uncertainty about whether he would die. He was uncertain about when that would happen. And he says in chapter 4, verse 12, that whether he abounds or abases, he wants to live in such a way that Christ is glorified. So he wasn't concerned about how much money he had, the comfort, creature comforts that he had. He again was concerned about Christ. And number three, he was bold in his confidence in God's control. There in verse 22, Paul says that I don't know what to choose. I'm caught in the middle. On the one hand, I could depart and be with Christ. Now, that's the easy choice. As much as death troubles us, the easy choice for the Christian is to die, to depart and be with Christ. Because when you die, it's happily ever after. That's not the way it is in this life. Some of our members right now are struggling in a very unhappy situation. But when the Christian dies, it's happily ever after. And Paul says to do that would be far better. No comparison. He tells us in verse 6 of this chapter that we are to, and 7, we're to approve the things that are excellent. And one of the first choices we make is the choice for heaven over this life. But Paul says, an argument can be made that I need to stay here for a while longer. And he's willing to do that, even though it means imprisonment, even though it means persecution, all kinds of negative things. I'm willing to stay here. I think this was the second greatest thing Paul ever said. The greatest has to be what he said in Romans chapter 9 when he says, I would rather be accursed for my brethren's sake if that would bring them to Christ. Paul was willing to go to hell for his Jewish brethren's salvation. But here he's willing to postpone heaven for his Christian brethren's edification. And so Paul was very bold in speaking his concern for God's glory, his contempt for his own comfort, and his confidence in God's control. Whatever happened, he was confident it would work out to God's glory. And then that brings us to verse 21. And let me ask you this. If you were to summarize the essence of your life in a single short sentence, how would it read? Some people, if they were honest about their life and they were offering a summary of it, would say, like Paul says in chapter 3, verse 19, my God is my belly. That's what some would say. They would say what their life is about are their desires, living at the level of their appetite. If they've got a taste for something, they're going to indulge that taste. That's where they live, regardless of whether what they have a taste for is righteous or not. You know, wisdom is having the ability to know which impulses to obey and which impulses are to be made obedient. We have impulses that we should not give in to. We have some that we ought to follow, but some that we shouldn't follow. We need to know which ones to give into and which impulses are to be brought under discipline and under our control. Some, if they were honest about the essence of their life, might say what Paul says in chapter 3, verse 2, I'm a dog. Look at chapter 3, verse 2. Beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the concision. Now, Paul's talking about being a legalist. And he calls him a dog. And that's not very polite in our politically correct climate. But he says they're a dog. You know why he called him a dog? Because a legalist is a danger to your spirituality. Just like a mad dog that you got to keep chained up and on a leash. You let that dog loose, and that dog's going to hurt someone. The legalists were people who hurt other people. They were evil workers. That's not how they would describe themselves. That's how Paul describes them. The result of what they did was for evil, not for good. They were of the concision, the circumcision. They were more interested in looking good than in being good. They were more interested in style than in substance. And so if you ask people in one short sentence to give me a definition of yourself, there'd be various answers. But in verse 21, in 6 monosyllabic words, Paul gives us the essence of his life. For me, to live is Christ. And I think in those 6 words, there are 3 points to be making, and those are going to be the 3 points in the outline this morning. And I'll try to state them and say something about each one of them. Let's begin by taking the first 2. For me. And the point I would make about what Paul was from these 2 words is that for him, Christianity was personal. It was not vicarious. He was not trying to live Christian through the life of somebody else. Sometimes people try to glom on to a good person, to a righteous person, and thinking that by somehow or other connecting themselves to that person, that's going to make them like that person. And that's not necessarily the case. For Paul, his Christianity was personal. It was not traditional. It was not denominational. He had made a personal, voluntary decision to become a Christian. He had not been baptized to please his parents. He had not been baptized so that he could marry somebody. He was baptized because of a personal decision there on the road to Damascus when Christ appeared to him. What Paul says, "Lord, what do you want me to do?" Now that's what the person who makes Christianity personal is going to ask. What do you want me to do? That is the basic question. Now, in thinking about what it means to make Christianity personal, one of the best ways I can try to explain that is to think about what it means to be married. Paul in Ephesians 5 says that the marriage relationship is a really good paradigm of the relationship between us and God, between the church and Christ. So what does it mean to be personally invested in a marriage? Well, the first thing it means is that you voluntarily married. Nobody put a gun to your head. Nobody forced you into it. You did not have any ulterior motives in getting married other than to be in a relationship with the person you're marrying. And because you made that personal decision, there is going to be an allegiance between you and the person you marry. You're going to be loyal to them. And in your loyalty, you're going to do things that will help you understand what it means to be a Christian. Let me mention just a few. In a marriage, hopefully you will grow to the point where you can love your partner without expecting anything in return. Very often what we do is tit for tat. I'll scratch your back, but I expect you to scratch my back. If you think marriage is a 50-50 proposition, you don't know the half of it. Because in a happy marriage, each is willing to give their all, 100%, if that's what it means for them to be married. And you're going to do that expecting nothing in return. That's the highest level of love that we can attain into. In a marriage, you're going to learn that it depends not so much on looking into each other's eyes, gazing at each other, as it depends on both of you looking in the same direction. You both have the same goals. You have the same outcome, the same target in view. And you're looking at that together. You're going in a marriage to prove your love for the other by trusting them. There are times they may be away. You're not with them. You don't know what they're doing, but you trust that they're doing the right thing. And in being a Christian, there are going to be many times where we don't understand why the groom is dealing with his bride the way he is. We don't understand why God allows certain things to happen, but we trust Him. And we're wanting to spend our time with Him. Get into His Word. Be with His people. Because familiarity can breed love. Yeah, it can breed contempt, but familiarity can also breed love. The more you know about a person, the more you can love that person. And so what does it mean to say that Christianity is personal? Well, think about your own marriage if you are married. And about all the personal commitment you made to be in that marriage. Paul goes on to say, "For me to live is Christ." Christianity is not only personal, it is practical. When you tell someone in a marriage, "I love you," what that means is you're not just going to sit there, you're going to get up and do something. That is an absolute implication of love. Love does something. Now, there are people who will try to convince you they love you by their talk. They'll talk all day about how much they really and truly love you. And maybe you can convince someone simply by talk that you do love them. But if you really want to convince someone that you love them, get up and do something. Do something that shows love. Love that is only talked about can be easily dismissed. But when you show someone that you love them by your action, they're going to think you are irresistible. They'll think you are irreplaceable when you are showing you love them by your action. Love is to be personal. We're to make the commitment to Jesus Christ. But love also involves action. Paul says in Philippians 2, we are to work out our own salvation. There are things that are expected of us as a Christian. You know, in a marriage, you're with the other person, you often spend a lot of time together, but you often also, despite the fact you're together, spend time alone. And there are two words that we have in our language, both built on the idea of being alone, that talk about the two sides of the coin. One of those words is the word solitude. Now, solitude involves the joy of being alone. When a person is seeking solitude, they're not empty inside. You know, you've heard about the monasteries in Asia, in Africa, in Europe, Egypt. They had monasteries in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Sahara Desert. The most famous monastery from ancient times was the Siwa Oasis. It was in the middle of nowhere. Alexander the Great went there. He made a trip, but died on the way to the middle of nowhere because the temple of Amon was at Siwa. And Jupiter was the god honored at that temple. And people went there to talk to the oracle, the priest, and get answers to questions. That's how important they thought it was. And men, hermits, would go there and live in caves. They did the same thing at Mount Sinai. The St. Catherine Monastery at Mount Sinai, filled with men who just wanted to be alone, but who wanted to be alone that they might devote themselves to contemplating the truth of God, to studying the Bible, reading the Bible, understanding the Bible. They were alone, they were in solitude, but their lives were full. Say what you want about hermits, you'll never catch me being a hermit. But those men who were hermits were inwardly full in their commitment, in their dedication and devotion. But there's another word that doesn't speak about the joy of being alone, but about the pain of being alone, and that's the word loneliness. And you can be in the middle of a mob, you can be in the middle of a crowd, you can have a wife, you can have a husband, a spouse, and you're absolutely lonely. You're empty inside. For me, to live means in your life, there's not only the allegiance, but there is the action and the commitment to another that fills up your life inwardly, and what you filled your life with becomes the controlling factor in your life. Michael Faraday, one of the most famous scientists of the Western world, Einstein kept a picture of Faraday on the walls of his study. Michael Faraday had very little education. He was English, very little formal education, but taught himself the principles of electricity. So much so that he is now called the father of electricity. And there was no more popular scientist in England during his time than Michael Faraday. People would come to hear him lecture, and there's a story told about him giving a lecture before the Royal Society in London one time, and the Prince of Wales was in attendance. The Prince of Wales became Edward VII, King of England, son of Queen Victoria. He was there at the lecture. Faraday got up, gave his lecture, showed an experiment, and when the experiment concluded, the entire auditorium broke into thunderous applause. Men were on their feet, and they started shouting for Faraday to come out and take a bow, and they looked for him, and they couldn't find him anywhere. He was gone. While they were clapping, he left the building. You know where he went? I'm going to put it in our language. He went to the Wednesday night Bible study when there was about seven people there. That's where he went. He was a Christian. Faraday was a Christian. He was an elder of a small church of about 20 people. And it was more important for him to go to that assembly and pray with those people and study the Bible than for him to stay and receive the applause of the Prince of Wales. For him to live. Men, on that night every week, he was with those Christians, those believers. Paul keeps going. He says, "For me to live is Christ." Christianity is not only personal, it's not only practical because it puts us to work. Christianity is possible. For him to live was Christ. If you notice in your Bible, the little verb is probably italicized because it's not in the Greek. What Paul says in the Greek is, "For me to live, Christ!" Exclamation point. His life was all about Christ. And there are people who say, you know, I tried Christianity. I tried living the Ten Commandments. I could get about six of them, but that was about as far as I could get. And trying to live the Sermon on the Mount, oh, just forget that. There's no way in the world I can live up to what the Sermon on the Mount talks about. And so what do you say to a person who's tried and has failed and is ready to give up because of that? Well, let me give you a verse that Paul's already given us. Go back to chapter 1, verse 6. Here's what Paul says there. "But we need to be confident of this very thing, namely that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ." I tried it, I couldn't do it. Well, maybe the reason is because you were trying to do it on your own. Maybe the reason is because you didn't give God a real chance to work in you. The work that was begun of giving you life was God. He's the one who did that. It may have been Paul who planted, it may have been Apollos who watered, but it was God who gave you life. And God who allows that life to increase, to grow, to mature. And we need to be confident that what God has started in us, He's going to finish. Have you ever gone to a website on the internet and a page comes up that says, "Under construction"? You know, they're still making the page. If you look yourself up on the internet, that's what you would find. We're all under construction. God is still working. He hasn't gotten us to where He intends for us to go yet. And God sometimes has to remind His workers to stay at the job I've given you. We were talking Wednesday night about Zerubbabel, the governor of the Jews, the civil governor when the Jews came back to Jerusalem, and they're supposed to be building the temple, and they'd run into all kinds of problems and obstacles. And finally, in the very last verse of the book, God says, "Zerubbabel, listen, you are my signet. And a signet was an emblem, usually in a ring, of royal authority. And so they'd bring something to the king for him to read over and approve. And if he approved it, they'd put a gob of wax on the papyrus and he'd smack his ring into that. And that meant the king's approved it. This has kingly authority behind it. God tells Zerubbabel, my authority is backing you. I've got your back. You do what I've told you. You get to work. Be practical. Build the temple. I'll make sure you have everything you need to do it. I'll back you all the way. Don't worry what it's looking like. There were some there in Jerusalem who looked at the temple they were rebuilding from the rubble that the Babylonians had left. Some of them had seen Solomon's temple, the most expensive building ever built. And they knew what they were putting up looked like a chicken coop compared to what Solomon built. And they said, oh man, it's not worth it. God says, no, there's going to be more glory in the latter house than in the former. Now get to work and build it. I'll back you up. And so that's what God says to each of us. He who has begun a good work in you will finish it. God's not going to bail out on us. We're not to bail out on Him. And then Paul says, after he said, for me to live is Christ, he says, to die is gain. Where would we be if we did not have those words? To die is gain. If you didn't think death was a promotion, if you didn't think death ushered you into happily ever after, we'd all be in the worst depression imaginable. Fatalistic, no meaning to our life whatsoever. But Paul says, for the one to whom life is Christ, death is a promotion. Death is a blessing. What do we gain when we die? I'll tell you one thing we gain. We gain direct access to Christ. Christ now blesses us through each other. He has no hands but our hands. His blessings are mediated through men. But in heaven, we're in direct contact with Christ. His goodness, His kindness, His love, His mercy. We're all going to receive that without any filtering between Him and us. And on top of direct access to the one who loves us more than anyone else are all the blessings that He will give us. The life, the adventures, the excitement, the anticipation, the health, everything that we have in heaven. To die is gain. And knowing what we have to gain, then that makes the determination to live as Christ even greater. Let this mind be in you, which was in the Apostle Paul. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain.